UCCF's Be Thinking website, bethinking.org, offers you free access to some of the finest apologetics resources in the world. Make sure you sign up as a BeThinker to receive our monthly email. The BeThinking email is packed with handy information highlighting new articles, film, book and music reviews, and is filled with practical examples of how you can make good use of the excellent and insightful material on BeThinking.org to help you grow as a thinking Christian. BeThinkers combine a good understanding of the issues with a character that shows that the biblical truths that the BeThinker describes are authentic and life-changing. Log on to BeThinking.org and become a BeThinker today.
All right, first of all, let's pray, and then we will dive in. Dear Father, thank you for giving us this opportunity. Thank you for allowing us to see what's going on in the world and to respond to it. Please, I pray that you would give me wisdom, you would give my brothers and sisters wisdom, and that what I say would be helpful and encouraging to them. In your son's name we pray. Amen. There's a friend of mine who was standing in line one day. I think it was at the post office. He's an Englishman, and like many people who come from the land of Monty Python, he was just tainted ever so slightly by the absurd. And he turned to the person behind him in line and said, "You're a lemon." And the man was kind of taken aback, and he said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "Oh, you're a large yellow fruit." And he said, I beg your pardon, I'm not a lemon." And I said, "Well, how do you know you're not a lemon?" And they got into this very, you know, this debate about epistemology and how does one know who you really are. That's sort of what I want to talk about, except we're not going to be going after lemons. I want to talk about that issue. How do you know who you are? But take it even deeper. The kind of question you ask when you're lying awake at 3 a.m. and you're looking at the ceiling and you can't fall asleep and you say, "Who am I? What am I doing here? Where is my life going anyway?" Now, once upon a time, that question was fairly easy to answer. It's never been an easy question, but once upon a time, it was a lot easier than it is now. In pre-modern times, you would say, "Who am I?" "Well, what does the church tell you?" "Well, you're a soul who is in God's care." "What does society tell you?" "You are a landless serf, and your duty is to your master," etc., and so forth. So you knew who you are. Nowadays, it's identity is no longer given in quite the same way, and people feel kind of rootless and unstable due to a number of factors: postmodern philosophies, the conditions of late modernity, or what some call postmodernity. I'm going to propose to you that we need to be able to give an answer to those who are struggling in this way. And so here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to give you a short history of identity as we move from modernity into postmodernity. And then I'm going to give, and we're going to kind of end up with three postmodern philosophers, and I'm going to give you little snapshots, Augenblick, of each of these guys. And then I'm going to give an apologetical response to these guys. And finally, I'm going to present what I think are at least the beginnings of a Christian understanding of identity. Now, before I get going, there's a number of you who I know are not native speakers. You have my admiration and gratitude for even being here. However, sometimes when I get excited, I will start talking really, really fast, and then you get a bit of... So if I do that, please just raise your hand and say, "Whoa, cowboy, you're Dutch, but you're still American." So so just raise your hand and say, "Whoa, cowboy, slow down. Okay? The other thing, if you want to interrupt at any time, you may do so. I've timed this out, so I'm only supposed to be talking for 45 minutes. And Greg... You know, there you go. But if we get into conversation before my end time, that's fine. It just might cut into the 45 minutes. So first, before I begin our story time, kids, we're going to talk about, let me give you some terminology. I'm going to be talking about isms. When I'm talking about an ism, ISM, I'm talking about an ideology or philosophy, all right, Marxism, modernism, postmodernism. When I'm talking about an itty, I-T-Y, I'm talking about a social condition, a sociological condition, like postmodernity or modernity. It's not quite the same thing. And finally, when I talk about an ization, I'm talking about a process of social transformation, secularization, modernization, postmodernization, that sort of thing. The reason I'm giving you all these little end bits is because I don't want this to just be, and this philosopher said this, blah, 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 blah. And then this philosopher said this, blah, 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 blah. Those are very interesting, but they tend to be a little ungrounded if you never talk about the social conditions in which they occur. So what I'm going to be doing is I'm going to be shifting gears between the what the philosophers say and then to the social conditions, hopefully without grinding the gears too badly. So that you can see how these ideas had social consequences and, even more importantly, how the social conditions in which these guys spoke kind of opened up a way for them to talk about identity in new ways and destabilize old senses of identity. This is what overeducated people call a dialectic, okay? All right, so our story starts, as most stories that have to do with modernism do, with René Descartes, je suis donc, whoops, I got that backwards, je pense donc je suis, or cogito ergo sum, I think therefore I am. Society doesn't have to tell me who I am, I know I am, simply by doubting all around me, okay? So that through a method of doubt, Descartes came to a place where he said, I think, therefore I know I am. And what am I? I am the thing that thinks, right? What is the thing that thinks? This is the basis for... I need to put this up. This is the basis for postmodern identity.
All right, I'm sorry, modern identity.
That's better. The self for modernism is rational, transparent. That is, your motivations are transparent to yourself. There are no hidden, irrational, subterranean desires to get in the way of your understanding yourself. It is in control. Later thinkers would call it a sovereign self. This is a profoundly powerful and comforting idea, but it becomes destabilized by romanticism and things like that, but especially by the social conditions associated with modernity. Modernity corrodes the modern sense of self. And it does this through three processes associated especially with the Industrial Revolution in the West. The first is called urbanization, the second is called privatization, and the third is a shift in public values. So let me talk about those very quickly. Urbanization undermined traditional community. Traditional communities were total communities. The people you worked with were the same people you went to church with, were the same people you saw at the pub. Everybody was kind of there for each other, reestablishing day by day your identity. It's easy for you to know who you are when people around you kind of know who they are and they reinforce your identity. But that condition is lost as people start moving to the city because in the new economy, farming jobs were being lost and industrial jobs were being opened up in this new industrial economy. The traditional total community was replaced by a new fragmented community. The people you worked with were no longer the ones you went to church with, if you went to church, were no longer the ones you went to school with, were no longer the ones that you saw in your neighborhood. And each one of those different groups acted and believed in just slightly different ways. So your sense of self kind of gets spread over these different groups, and they're giving you competing signals about who you are. The net effect of that is a splintering and a fragmenting of identity, a destabilizing of this modern self-assured identity. Changes in work patterns led to a privatization of the self. Used to be that in the traditional community, dad worked alongside of the children and mom, whether that was in a craft workshop or in the fields. But all of a sudden in the new economy, dad goes away to work in an office or in a factory. And there, and he's going to work in what becomes known as the real world, the workaday world. So what you have now is you have a split between the private world of the home, which is the woman's world, and the public real world of money and commerce and labor. Mom stays home and teaches the children. Dad goes off and earns the money. Guess where the sense of self is developed? It's developed at home. It's developed in this private kind of sentimental world of mom and children and stuff like that. So the sense of self becomes privatized. It's now no longer, who you are is no longer a public observable thing, but rather it's a matter of private opinion. That's privatization. Thirdly, at the same time, there's a shift in public values. At the workplace, traditional ethics, godliness, kindness, gentleness, all, you know, the fruits of the spirit, that sort of stuff, are now obsolete. And that traditional ethics was a big part of who you were. What replaces it? Well, it doesn't matter if you're particularly kind. It's, can you get the job done? Do you have a good technique? Are you efficient? Can you work well with others? So the one area that was considered most important to who you are is all of a sudden out of place. It has no home. There's a shift in public values to, and what is considered most real is now no longer who you are. The net effect, fragmenting of identity. So the end result of all these changes of urbanization, of privatization, of the shift in public values is, these three together are what some sociologists call secularization, is a draining of meaning from public life. Meaning and identity, including religion, were shoved to the from the public sphere and now become private, leisure time activities, like a club. But efficiency and technique, that these new public values, couldn't provide identity, meaningful identities for many people. I go to work and I'm an office clerk in an insurance company, and I'm a darn good office clerk in an insurance company, but is there more to me than that? I mean, come on, there has to be. I have to be more than Joe Smith, office clerk. There's got to be more. And what we see is people searching around for other ways of constructing their identities, other ways of understanding who they are. And you get these, what used to be secular sorts of realities, sex, sports, nationality and ethnicity, human creativity and potential. These things used to be secular, and they take on a sacred significance, a sacred identity-forming significance. All right, that's the destabilization that goes on in modern identity because of modernism. At the end of the 19th century, at the height of the Industrial Revolution, you get three brilliant thinkers who radically questioned the self-assured modernist identity. And they were able to do so because the destabilization and fragmentation that came about because of the social conditions of modernity. They are now called the masters of suspicion. Vim was talking about them a couple nights ago. I'm only going to mention three, not Darwin. Karl Marx, Sigmund Freud, and Friedrich Nietzsche. For Karl Marx, identity, that is your sense of self, who you are really, is a function of your social and economic location. Marx says, it is not the consciousness of men that determines their being, but on the contrary, it is their social being, and by which he means class, that determines their consciousness. In other words, you aren't who you think you are. You aren't who you determine yourself to be. Rather, you are who you are given to be within a certain economic setup. Are you petty bourgeois? Are you lumpen proletariat? Are you whoever? That's completely outside your control. That destroys the sort of self-assured identity that that was taught by Descartes. Sigmund Freud taught that identity is not stable or rational, but it's an ever-conflicted tension between the ego, your conscious, rational mind. Yeah, just grab some of them. Between your ego, your conscious, rational mind, and the id, which is the seat of this animalistic, aggressive nature, these desires. Who you are is not transparent, especially to you. We need one more over here for the... three more over here. Who you are is not transparent, especially to you. You are shaped by forces outside your control. And by forces you may not even remember. Your earliest relationship with your parents, your potty training. All of this stuff plays into who you are now and constructs these subterranean desires which make you prey to obsessions, compulsions, neuroses. We are compulsive beings, said Freud, driven by a desire for sex, a desire for control over others, even a desire for death. Freud paints a much darker, more dangerous picture of the human psyche. Our sense of self, contrary to the modernist picture, is very much dislocated and in disarray. And finally, Friedrich Nietzsche. His critique was perhaps the most radical of all. He questioned the whole basis for modern identity, for modern Western philosophy as a whole. There is no such thing as truth. There are only interpretations of the truth. There is no truth we can get through to by rational means. For there are only these interpretations. The ethical self, which is, let's be honest, a root of who we think we are, Nietzsche said, these are not values that are true. Rather, we must these values have to be shown to be historical constructions. And he does that through a process he calls genealogy, which is a kind of an archaeology of the way values develop. You go back and you unearth these selfish, power-hungry motivations, which we then baptize along the way and call true. For example, Christian selflessness, you know, virtue. He says, that's a weak slave morality. You want to know what it really is? It's resentment against the powerful. The only reason you Christians love these people is because, yes, I'm going to be good and loving, but I know it's because you're going to hell and I'm not. And that's what Christian morality boils down to. The real self, according to Nietzsche, breaks free from these traditional bounds of morality. And it transcends these traditional limits and expresses itself in a Dionysian will to power, a sort of free circulating vitality that draws the great towards greatness and true freedom. So these masters of suspicion, building upon the destabilization that was already happening because of the Industrial Revolution and the consequences of that, laid the critical foundation that later postmodernist thinkers would build upon. Okay, now we're going to shift gears again and go back to the social conditions again. Skip ahead lots and lots of decades. We've been talking about guys who were writing in the late 19th century. Early 20th centuries. Now skip ahead. The world is no longer ruled by industry, but by information. Welcome to the postmodernist world, what some people call postmodernity. And just as modernity paved the way for a questioning of identity, postmodernity does the same. The social conditions of postmodernity both poses identity as a question, and a question that may well have no answer. And it gives a certain credibility to the postmodernist thinkers who argue along those lines. So, what are the conditions of postmodernity? Postmodernity is not something completely different than modernity. It's a continuation. It's a kind of the seeds planted by modernity coming to fruition, coming to flower. And what it does is it flowers into a whole new understanding of reality and truth. Not in all areas. I mean, if you guys were here for the apologetics thing and Bill Craig was talking about how people don't tend to take a postmodernist view of science, he's right. Social structures tend to be very modernist. Science as an institution tends to be modernist. But I wouldn't agree with him that postmodernism or postmodernity, more importantly, is a myth. It's a hybrid form that's still coming into emergence. It's not quite there yet. But these attitudes, these new attitudes towards reality are shaped according to sociologist David Lyon. And if you haven't read his book, Jesus in Disneyland, you ought to. It's a fabulous book. This new understanding of reality is shaped by two social realities, two processes. One is the rise of new media technologies, cinema, computers, the internet, but especially television. And secondly, the dominance of a sort of hyper-consumerism in society. So let's look at these two things and see how they affect identity. First, the rise of new media technologies. We live in a mediated world unlike any generation before us. Whereas before, social interaction was dominated by face-to-face interaction, conversations. Now we have the mobile telephone, SMS, and email. I'm aghast that people's thumbs don't start falling off by the millions. You know, I see all these people going, you know, it's just new ways of communication, mediated communication. Whereas before, we passed on our stories through books or through conversations or storytelling around the fireside. Now we are flooded with stories and messages from cinema, radio, the TV, internet. Postmoderns exist in a world saturated with media messages. And in dialogue with these messages, they negotiate personal meaning. They start understanding or try to understand who they are. The net effect, pun intended, of this is twofold. Number one, these media messages tend to question and problemize traditional authorities. For example, the church, or in extreme cases, even science. And they do this sometimes by the sheer volume of information that we are impacted by. How can there be one perspective that on truth, on reality, when we get so many different messages from so many different perspectives? As one Islamic cultural critic said, the threat to Islam today is not so much Jesus as Madonna. The media is the threat to authoritative understandings of the self. Second, these media messages and stories provide frames or frameworks through which we organize experience. The media provides us tools through which we organize experience. The media provides us with a sense of what's real, and paradoxically, it blurs the line between reality and fiction until it becomes harder and harder to distinguish between the two. All becomes what Jean Baudrillard called simulacra, representations of representations of representations of representations without any original. You know, think of reality TV. The more real they try to... I don't know if... You guys know reality TV? Okay, good. Or bad. The more real the TV producers try to get it, the more bizarre and forced and unnatural it becomes. So what is real? This meaning-organizing function of media is one of the reasons I think it is vital for apologetics to be in dialogue with media and popular culture, because it's just here that meaning and identity is formed in culture today, in society today. So these media messages shape our identity, our sense of self. For postmoderns, identity is seen not as fixed, but as fluid. Not as given, but as in process. We are always constructing and reconstructing ourselves through the messages we take in and use. Identity for postmoderns is often fragmentary, shifting from one context to another. You're one person at home, another person at school. And on the internet, you can be five or six different people, depending on which multi-user domain you're in or which chat room you're visiting at the moment. So the effect of the rise of media technologies, such as TV and the internet, is to question authority and destabilize identity. The second process we're going to look at is the rise of hyper-consumerism. The messages of these new media technologies that fragment identity are mostly, if not wholly, commercial in nature. Most of the media messages we received are marketing in one way or another. Everything can now be marketed and commodified that is presented as a consumer product, including religious faith. Including identities. So if the barrage of messages help fragment the postmodern identity, consumer culture helps reintegrate them. It puts the pieces back together, though not in the way that modernism gives identity. These identities are not stable, not fixed, not given, not transparent. So what does it mean to live in a consumer-dominated culture? It changes the way we define ourselves. Time was, once upon a time, we defined ourselves as producer. Who are you? Well, I am Ted. I teach at a college, blah, 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 blah. What do you produce? What do you work? What's your work? Now people are increasingly more apt to define themselves as consumers. What we consume, how we are entertained, our lifestyle, the emphasis on image and success, what clothes you wear. What car you drive, what kind of apartment you live in, where you go on vacation, what music you like to listen to, what movies you liked, all of that stuff all comes from this shift. Part of the postmodern landscape is we are what we consume. The new consumer identity, consumer-oriented identity, has two aspects, according to Lyon. There is, first of all, the plastic self. That is, identity is completely changeable, plastic, bendable, able to be bent and shaped to our desire. Identity is something we try on, like we try on clothes or new hairstyles. For postmoderns, even sexual partners or marriages can be tried on and then discarded if that's not who you feel like you are. The goal in all of this is to maximize experience, to try and to taste all that you can in order to expand your horizons. Be as flexible as you can be in order to be all that you can be, to use the U.S. Army advertising slogan. This is consumer choice applied to identity. But paradoxically, there's another aspect to identity, to consumerist identity, that longs for depth and authenticity. The expressive self, rather than simply seeking expression or expansion through experience, seeks depth through an ongoing inner story of development and enrichment. This sort of identity longs for validation, authentication, but not from an external authority like a religious institution or even from science. Science is not, for all that people believe in science, nobody believes that science can tell you who you are, really. Rather, it seeks for an authenticity from within. The expressive self longs to find something that harmonizes with that inner voice and completes your inner story. Of course, the plastic self, with its tendency for expansion and thereby shallowness, and the expressive self, with its tendency for inner depth and therefore self-absorption, can be combined and coalesced in any number of ways. The New Age has made a science out of combining the two. That is, deepening your inner self through expanding your experiences. Not all postmoderns follow the New Age path, but all are marked to some extent by this sort of twofold consumerist identity. putting all of these together, the effects of new media technologies and consumerism on identity, the postmodern person is one who, one, is suspicious of external authority to tell them who they are, whether that's science or the church. Two, is suspicious of claims to absolute truth. There are too many such claims in an age of media marketing. Three, has problems with the concept of absolute reality, since media blurs that the distinction between the real and the image. Fact and fiction often are seen to blend. Isn't reality just a sort of fiction? And fourthly, they may not see themselves in terms of a single stable identity, but rather as a fluid identity in process, or even as multiple identities in process. But always, 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 and note this, always with a kind of a core identity of consumer choice, somewhere where you can choose from. And finally, the postmodern longs for authenticity and unity, a completion to their personal story. Bless you. This is what happens to identity under the influence of the social conditions of postmodernity. And in light of the social conditions, of these social conditions, what postmodern thinkers say makes some sense. Now, we're going to talk about three postmodern thinkers, and all three of these have participated in a certain sense in what postmodern theorists call the linguistic turn. For postmodern thinkers, the self is seen as largely a construction of language. Since it is language, it's in language that human meaning is created. But unlike earlier structuralist thinkers like Ferdinand de Saussure or Levi-Strauss, language is not seen as necessarily a stable system. Rather, these thinkers see language as a system always in motion, meanings always slipping around. It's very hard to pin down meanings under various social pressures. So language is itself inherently unstable, and hence they are called post-structuralists. They're not structuralists, they're post-structuralists. And since the self is a construction of language, an unstable language system further destabilizes the sense of self. We're going to look at three of these postmodernist thinkers: Michel Foucault, Jacques Lacan, and Paul Ricoeur. Michel Foucault, the French historian and philosopher, said, what is reality or identity? The bottom line reality for Foucault is something that he calls power knowledge. Power knowledge is his term for the way power is built upon knowledge. That is, when you go to see the doctor, he sort of has you, doesn't he? Because he's mastered a discourse that you don't master. You know, and certain doctors will even play that to their advantage. Well, you have a metastasis of this. Oh, yes, doctor. Okay, sure, whatever you say. But power knowledge also refers to the way that power produces its own fields of knowledge and truth, quote unquote. For example, the way the power of the psychiatrist produces a knowledge that constructs the identity of the insane person he's treating. When a psychiatrist treats somebody, he's actually exercising a knowledge that exists for the purpose of empowering the psychiatrist and constructing the identity of the patient. All in the name of psychiatric truth. Let me read these quotes. Power produces knowledge. Power and knowledge directly imply one another. There is no power relation without the correlative constitution of a field of knowledge, nor any knowledge that does not presuppose and constitute at the same time power relations. Second, in another context, in an interview, he said, truth isn't outside of power or lacking power. Contrary to a myth, whose history and functions would repay further study, truth isn't the reward of free spirits, the child of protracted solitude, nor the privilege of those who have succeeded in liberating themselves. Truth is a thing of this world. It is produced only by virtue of multiple forms of constraint, that is, the exercise of power. And it induces regular effects of power. Each society has its regime of truth, its general politics of truth. That is, types of discourse which it accepts and makes function as true. The mechanisms of and instances which enable one to distinguish true and false statements. The means by which each is sanctioned, the techniques and procedures accorded value in the acquisition of truth, the status of those who are charged with saying what counts as true. So, for instance, feminist thinkers have taken up Foucault. You know, what does it mean to be a woman in this society? What does it mean to be a true woman? Does it mean to, you know, where is true womanhood found? Well, that depends on the discourse that you are involved in, doesn't it? And whichever the dominant discourse of your society is, you are going to find if you buck that system by, say, becoming a lesbian, you're going to be marginalized. You're going to be outside that regime of truth and therefore adjudged to be wrong in some sense, just in your identity. So our identity is constructed by the discourses we are caught in, the truth games that we're part of, games that serve the interests of power. That's why many postmodernists prefer the term subjectivity. We become subjects, that is an I, to the extent that we are subjected to these regimes of truth, to these power, these circulations of power discourse. It's only as we're enslaved to the power discourses circulating around us that we are constructed as selves. Later in his career, Foucault talked about ways that you could construct your own identities, making your life a project of beauty or an aesthetics of the self, he called it. Identity for him was so malleable, so unstable, so unrooted from any source of deeper truth that eventually it became a burden for him. Towards the end of his life, he was deeply involved in the sadomasochistic underground in San Francisco's gay community. He was actively seeking what Nietzsche would call limit experiences, experiences that would wipe out any consciousness that you are, that would just make you forget yourself. And perhaps because the fact that we are nothing but social constructions became unbearable. The second thinker I'm going to talk about is Jacques Lacan. He was a French psychoanalyst who interpreted Freud in light of the new postmodern emphasis on language. For example, he studied infants and noticed that at a certain stage, around 6 months old, they became fascinated with their own image in a mirror. Monkeys of the same age, we just kind of look at it, say, oh, okay, and then go away. But infants, once they were able to recognize themselves, would just sit there and lean forward and stare at themselves and become delighted and giggle and laugh like this was the best thing in the world. And he's saying, what is going on with that? He called this the mirror stage. And it doesn't have to be a mirror. The child can recognize itself in the gaze of the mother who says, there you are. You know, and saying, ah, mommy's seeing me. I'm seeing myself in my mom seeing me. The reason why, Lacan said, the baby is so interested in the mirror is because it is born unprepared for life. When it comes into the world, it lacks motor skills. It has no control over its motor functions, or very little control. It's getting all of this influx of information, and it lacks the ways to organize it. Life itself is fragmentary and chaotic. And what does it see in the mirror? It sees a picture of itself, unified, in control, coherent, whole. And that's something that the baby mistakes herself to be. Why mistakes herself? Because that's not her. It's an image of her, right? And that is why, that is the way we form identity throughout the rest of our lives. We look around for some image that is going to give us identity, which is going to give us a whole, stable, coherent identity, and then we put them on like pieces of armor, he says. We have an armature of these false images that we try to make identify with ourselves. We identify with different things. You know, your role as mother, your role as student, heroes in literature, or whatever. A new car that you buy. You know, this is going to be the thing that's going to tell me who I am and is going to give me coherence. But in each case, it doesn't. Why? Because it's not you. You isn't around to, it isn't accessible because it's only gotten through language, and language tends to fragment identity. So in the end, all of these images are going to disappoint us. Yes, Ellis. You did miss a beat. I for the sake of time, I left out another. At the age of around 18 months, the child enters the symbolic realm, and Lacan calls that the Fort Da game, which is really charming. Freud one time saw a child in a crib, and it had a spool with a string tied around it, and it would throw the spool and go, ooh, and then reel it back and go, ah, ooh, ah. And what Freud said is the child is saying Fort, which is German for there, and Da, which is here. And he's symbolically dealing with the absence of the mother. Mommy goes away, mommy comes back. Mommy goes away, mommy comes back. And Lacan, from his perspective, says that's what happens when the child reaches the next stage, which is the entrance into the symbolic realm, which is language. So I kind of left that out. I also left out his reading of the Oedipal stage, so which we can talk about. It's just time is short. So anyway, these images always fail to satisfy. Why? Because they're empty. And therefore, people are condemned to never really knowing who they are. And the best psychoanalysis can do is get you used to the fact that you'll never really know who you are. Never really have a grasp on reality. Finally, Paul Ricoeur. The French philosopher Paul Ricoeur understands the self as a question that is answered finally through stories. Who am I is a practical question. Ricoeur says, who am I that act? Who did this? Can I treat myself simply as a set of characteristics that generally act in this way? Or is there more to me than that? How I habitually act? The answer comes through the stories we read and hear and see in our culture. Ricoeur says that these stories put our sense of self through imaginative variations that force our true selves to emerge. What would we have done in Raskolnikov's position, or in Madame Bovary's, or in Mrs. Dalloway's, etc., etc., and so forth? It forces you to put yourself in the character's position, and by variation, another self emerges. But what's more than that, these imaginative variations reflect the reality of the situation. That is, that our sense of self is itself a fiction. It's a useful fiction, but it's nothing more than a fiction. It's a way that we understand ourselves as a unity, even as we go through many, many changes throughout our lives. Ricoeur calls this narrative identity. It's a way of our making sense of all the little projects that we're involved in, and at the same time, making sense of our life as one big grand project, a life plan in which we are engaged. We are, in a sense, both narrators and the main characters of our own stories. But it is an imaginative construction. Beyond that, the self is an answer, is a question without an answer. So what we're left with is the self, is the postmodern self, which is a construction, an imaginative construction, and one that can never be fulfilled according to these postmodern thinkers. Have you guys seen Man in the Moon? The Milos Forman picture? It's a biopic of the American comic Andy Kaufman. Andy Kaufman was like a walking performance theater. He would, what made him kind of very strange as an artist, as an actor, as a comedian, is that he had so many different alter egos. You know, he did killer Elvis impersonations before doing Elvis impersonations was cool, at least in America. He became this wrestling star, and he'd wrestle women just to annoy them, and challenge a woman to beat him. And one time a real pro wrestler challenged him and put him in traction, and nobody could figure out whether this was a stunt Andy had pulled or whether he really was suing this other wrestler. He had this alter ego named Tony Clifton, who is this big, fat lounge singer with big, bushy sideburns and dark glasses, and he'd just get up and he'd start abusing the audience. And he wouldn't let on that Tony Clifton and Andy Kaufman were the same person. And it got to the point where at the end of his life, when he had cancer and his wife was pushing him around in a wheelchair, everybody's saying, "Oh, Andy, you're at it again." And this movie, you get to the point where there really is no Andy Kaufman. He doesn't exist. There is no real him. He's just switching because all there are these imaginative constructions. All right, so let's move on to an apologetic response. I would argue that it is not enough merely to condemn postmodernism as truth decay or whatever, you know, and to say, yes, we as Christians have identity. We're made in the image of God and saved by the blood of the Lamb. So there, that, I would argue, fails to really engage the depth of the postmodern position. Rather, our response must be tailored to meet their challenge, recognizing both their insights and their errors. So what are the insights? I mean, what possible insights could a guy like Foucault and Lacan and Ricoeur have? Well, the insights I find in them is there's an understanding that identity is never static, but rather is in constant development because of power knowledge, the way society influences us, image formation, the way we run after these images, and let's face it, we do that, or the way that my character persists in time through many different events, through this story I tell about myself, which is Ricoeur. There is in postmodernism a healthy fear of the static and self-enclosed. They see it as stagnation stemming from a false, that is modernist, autonomy. A self that is in position of absolute authority, what I called earlier the sovereign self. So that's what they got right, in my opinion. What do they get wrong? That is, where are their paradoxes, contradictions, or unanswered questions that need to be answers that the postmodernists don't address, but they need to address? First of all, the first thing I'd say is there must be a stable given to identity. Otherwise, from where do I tell my stories about myself? From where do I resist the power knowledge circulations? Where do I resist these discourses? How is it possible that there ever exists a lesbian out there, for example, who resists the dominant discourse of femininity? From where can I say, you know, damn it, life should be different than this? And believe you me, that is crucial to postmodernist discourse, this power to resist where culture is oppressive. Without that, postmodernism falls apart. Second, in each case, I find the postmodern approach monological. What do I mean by that? The self speaks its own creation using language, cultural constructions. The self speaks itself into creation over a virtual abyss. Reality is a void. It's meaningless. A blank space for self-construction. That's what I mean by the self as monologue. And the ironic thing is that the postmodern monological self, actually replaces modernist autonomy with a far more radical autonomy, a more radical statement of the self as God. I can create myself however I want to. Thank you very much. As we shall see, a biblical understanding always sees the self in dialogue. All right, I'm going to quickly go over a biblical understanding of the self as both given and an ongoing project. When does this thing end, by the way? Is it, huh? 5:30. Supper is half past five. But, you know, everybody was late last time, so, you know. Yeah, that's right. It's all grace. It's all grace. It doesn't matter. Yeah. Okay. Any questions thus far? Okay. Yes. Uh-huh. Oh, but what? Absolutely. Yeah. I'm getting there. And Ricoeur actually acknowledges that we can't be our own author in quite the same way that others are their, that a book's author is an author. For example, we can't write our beginning, we can't write our end. And we don't have quite that authorial control. We are in a sense our own author, but in other senses we're not. So he recognized that. Ellis. The monologue. Very simple. The reality means nothing until man steps on a stage and starts speaking. That's what I mean by monologue. We create our own meaning. That's what I mean. We construct our own identities over the abyss. And I find the monologue a very unsatisfying way for understanding both reality and how we construct meaning. Because partly because there's no point of resistance to speak from in that case. We're just kind of making it up as we go along. Or we're being constructed and we have no possibility of real resistance, of any political resistance or any other kind of resistance. Foucault did. He, both. Both. Yeah. Yeah, I just mentioned some. Actually, to answer that question, let me give you kind of my take on a Christian understanding of identity, and maybe that will be answered as I go along. A biblical understanding of the self must respond to both these questions. Where is the self spoken from? What given? What do we have given? And it's in dialogue with what? And it has to respond to the insights of the postmodernists. It can't just be a rehashing of the modernist, static, stagnant identity in a Bible costume. The identity of the self that I'm going to lay out deals with creature identity, fallen identity, and redeemed/redemptive identity, following the pattern of the biblical story, creation, fall, redemption. And I put in creatural in your outline. That was just me being cheeky, so ignore that. Creature identity. The fact that we are created in God's image is not a static concept. God as Trinity is already a relational being and created us with certain capacities. We are hardwired for certain relational projects. We are hardwired for relation with God. That's what we call worship. We are hardwired for relationship with other humans. That's what we call love. We are hardwired for relationship with our world. That's what we call creativity or care. And that's found in the so-called cultural mandate of Genesis 1:26-28. Our sense of self, that is, our relationship with ourself, is given as we engage in these three dynamics, these three dynamic relationships. We are made to be other responsive creatures. This means that our identity as created in God's image is, in a sense, given. We have an inviolable worth and dignity. We have these certain capacities and creativities, etc., and so forth. But in another sense, our identity is an ongoing project, and perhaps it's a project without end, and that's not a scary thing. For example, when we get up to heaven, if my identity, my understanding of who I am, depends upon my relationship with God, is it ever going to finally come to a rest? No, I'm going to learn more and more and more about the mercy and power and awesome goodness of God and how that informs who I am. That he would bother with somebody like me is going to become more and more and more incredible. It's going to change who I am, who I see myself to be. So I build identity in dialogue with others that I am in contact with as an ongoing collaborative project. That's what identity is. Now, move to fallen identity. Sin has corrupted this relational project, distorting and fragmenting those relational capabilities. Our relationship with God, instead of being characterized by worship, is now characterized by idolatry and rebellion. Our relationship with other human beings, instead of being characterized by love, is characterized by manipulation, selfishness, abuse, superficial tolerance rather than love. We use people for our own ends, don't we? Our relationship with the world is characterized by domination, exploitation, carelessness, even in the extreme nature worship, or derivative kitsch rather than true creativity, instead of the care and creativity that we're called to. In this sense, the postmodernists often do a brilliant job at describing the dynamics of life in a fallen world, of describing these damaged, dysfunctional relational connections we have. But notice that these dysfunctional relationships are still relational and therefore revelational. They tell us something about God's wrath that is revealed against all godlessness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness, Romans 1. This relational mess that we find ourselves in just is Romans 1 bearing fruit in our lives. But notice that even those who do not recognize God's authority are still dependent upon him and his self-revealing creation for their identity, distorted as it has become. The fall has damaged and twisted, but not destroyed our creature identities. And finally, our redeemed and redemptive identity. That's not the whole story. The fall is not the whole story, as you guys know. God sent his Son to redeem us, and by the power of the Spirit, that relational damage can be substantially healed. Not perfectly, not yet, but substantially healed through an ongoing relationship with him. He adopts us. That is, he gives us a new identity as a child of God, which is, again, an interesting mixture of the stable and the given, and on the other hand, the dynamic and ongoing. The stable and the given would be no matter what, suffering, death of a loved one, something that shatters my identity, even my own sin, God has spoken. I am a beloved child. Romans 8:38. I'm convinced that neither this thing, or nor that thing, nor this thing, nor that thing can ever remove us from the love of God. That is, in Christ Jesus our Lord. The facts of the forgiveness of the cross and the power released by the resurrection stand firm, providing me with an unshakable identity, though the earth give way and the mountains fall into the heart of the sea, which is biblical language for even though all hell breaks loose. God is with us. On the other hand, the Spirit-filled reality is that our identities are an ongoing project. The Christian life is a journey of trials and temptations to be faced and sins to be repented of, people to be loved, gifts to be uncovered, sorrows to be endured, and through it all, of discovering more and more and more who I am in Christ. In this sense, Paul says in Philippians 3:12, not that I have already obtained all this or have been made perfect, but I press on to take hold of that for which Christ took hold of me. We continue to struggle with sin. We continue to discover the riches of Christ, continue to live, in a word. Our stories remain perpetually unfinished, even though the finish is, in a sense, already written. This is what theologians call the already not yet. You know, the battle has been won in Christ. We've got a lot of fighting to do. The identity offered to us in Christ is at once rock solid, a covenantal mercy given, not to be rescinded, and unfinished, an ongoing project of being used by God to heal a broken world and reflect his light into darkness. Let me just wrap up really quickly. In this way, the Christian understanding of identity is uniquely equipped to offer a challenging response to those caught in postmodernism and addicted to the flux of the postmodern self. The identity it presents is neither naive nor sovereign, but a realistic and healing contribution to the rootlessness and isolation of postmodernity. All right, I made it. So, any questions? Yes, Ellis. Ooh, that's a great question. There's a great article by John Fisk, all about Madonna. Madonna is the quintessential plastic self, is she not? She is the one who has, with an amazing media savvy, managed to remake herself again and again and again and again. When right after she put out this book, Erotica, or you know, this big book that of all sorts of pictures of Madonna, you know, one of my friends said to me, there's only one place left for her to go. That's to have a child. And sure enough, you know, next year, boom, she had a baby. You know, why? Well, because that's the only image she hasn't tried on yet. And now she's into this Hindu thing and these dye tattoo things and the henna dye. So she's pursuing Foucault's, as a resistance, as an act of resistance to the dominant discourse of femininity, she is doing Foucault's aesthetics of the self every day in every way. And if she does it right, she gets this kind of edge of resistance which makes her very, very marketable. So, yeah. Oh, let's Nicoletta speak. Uh-huh. Without Madonna? Yeah, the answer to your question is yes. The question was, who's doing that? These identity gymnastics. Is it the media or is it people like Madonna? And who needs who more? I guess, does Madonna need the media, or does the media need Madonna? Who's the mirror? And I would think that I would say yes. That is, it's not easily reducible to Madonna's just a reflection of the media. She's very conscious. She's very media savvy. But on the other hand, without the media, she is nothing. Yeah. Any media celebrity. And the answer is yes. She is enslaved and in control at the same time. It's a dialectical thing. She is informing media. She is being reflected out of the media. The media holds the strings. She holds the media. She plays them. They play her. Everybody's happy. Everybody makes lots of money. It's very postmodern. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I wouldn't be. It's all ambiguous, and I can't really. I mean, there really is a dialectic going on. There really is a feedback loop going on. They feed off of each other, and they control each other. And I would bet if you were the fly on the wall in the office of whatever recording company she's recording with now. And you heard the discussion between her and her producer from the record company, that would be very fascinating. You'd see some of that dialectic coming out. Yes, Ellis. Uh-huh. Right. 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 I mean, there was a starting point, which was this, well, I don't know. I mean, at one point, you know, she said in an interview about how disappointed her father was that, you know, she was raised a Catholic and she used to be this little, you know, my little girl is grown up. And, but who's to say that was her original identity? Time-wise, it was prior. But she has decided to discard that completely, and now, oh, I know, she's not into Hinduism anymore. It's Kabbalistic Judaism is her newest thing. So, which, according to traditional Kabbalistic Judaism, should not be open to females. The Kabbal is only for males who attain a certain level within Rabbinic Judaism. But you know. She's got the power. She can do it, and she can construct this whole other, the Jewish Madonna, the Jewish mystical Madonna. As far as Schoenberg, that sounds like a very postmodern notion. It sounds like Baudrillard's simulacra applied to music. Yeah. In this case, no. Architecture. Well, when was Schoenberg? 30s. Okay, I stand. But the first time that postmodernism as a self-conscious aesthetic movement, that was architecture. And I think you had a question. Yeah. Is this constructing one's own self? Yes. Yes and no. I would say, there's a lot of different things I could say. One is taking evangelicalism as I'm not talking about all of Christendom, all of Christianity right now, but just looking at evangelicalism as a social phenomenon, the proliferation of how-to material is all tied up with identity. That is to say, evangelical Christians are feeling the pinch of these postmodern, the dislocations of identity associated with the postmodern condition, the postmodern social conditions. That is a danger, and I see this very, you know, how to make your marriage better, how to do this, how to do that, da 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 da, da to be a not real encouraging trend in evangelicalism. So that's kind of the pejoratively stated. That it is a problem for evangelicals. Not pejoratively stated, an encouraging sort of thing is the sort of Christian identity that I laid out is a problem, but not an insuperable problem. It's not an insoluble problem. It is one that has an answer. It has an eschatological answer, finally. You know, who am I? Well, I am who I am going to become. I'm going to become glorified in Christ. I am going to my beloved, and my beloved is mine. Yeah, but what I am by the grace of God isn't this static thing. Life is a battle to be lived, and part of that battle, part of the spiritual battle we go through, is figuring out who the heck we are. And that comes by believing the promises of God day after day after day and rooting myself in them self-consciously day after day after day. So in a sense, I don't want to say Christianity's got it all wrapped up. In a sense, we do. That's the already. But in a sense, we don't. That's the not yet. Yes, Ellis. Yes. Yeah. Right. Yeah. It's not just power. It is a particular configuration of power that is consumer oriented. So the Christian life, a lot of times, and listen, folks, if you have how-to books at home, I'm not bashing you, and I had, you know, premarital, you know, having a more experienced Christian give you tips on how to do things well, you know, how to have a good argument with your wife without killing her or she killing you, that's a good thing. But that's relational. Yeah. Right. But what evangelicals like the rest of culture have become is to see the self as kind of a caddis worm. You guys know what a caddis worm is? Caddis worm are these little things that live in streams, about this long. They make great bait. And they kind of crawl along, and they construct their houses by picking up little rocks and pebbles and kind of gluing them around themselves. And they kind of accumulate more and more so they're not swept along by the stream. And I think that's the way postmodern evangelicalism or evangelicalism tends to see itself. Can I pick up this little skill? Can I enrich my spiritual experience this way? Can I, control my finances better so I'll get this book? Can I do this? Can I do this? And we're like caddis worms. Rather than what I see the Christian called to as a sort of a self-emptying, just put yourself out there and make yourself available to others. That is the way that Christianity is authenticated. And God gives you what you need. You know, again, if some of these books help you to do that, that's fine. But it's having the comfortable, self-assured lifestyle, how is that different from the consumerist West? Yes, Evald. At one point in my life, I was very enamored with Buber. But that was a long time ago, and I can't remember anymore. What, you want to say something, Tom? Sure. Yeah. Anybody? Yes. For you to be alone, right? There is a postmodern communal sort of identity, which crops up as a sort of neo-traditionalism. Neo-traditionalism. Postmoderns tend to be, if they're they're attracted by ritual. They're attracted by, you know, there's this, lots of people going over to the Orthodox Church. Why? Because they've got this highly ornate, very ancient seeming, very ancient mystical sort of thing in which they find a sort of a mystical community. Another thing that is very popular with postmodern Christians right now is Celtic spirituality. You know, these kind of Celtic monasteries where you go and you meditate and you find this communion with God and you find this kind of community. There is at once in postmodernism a very kind of cold, mechanical, some parts of, you read Foucault, you know, and you go, hi, yay, 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 and everything feels very cold because is there any love in Foucault? No, there is no relationship in Foucault that is not characterized by power. You know, when I say to my wife, I love you, what I'm saying is, welcome to my discourse where you're in a lower social hierarchy than I am. And as long as you participate in this discourse, we'll be fine. So that's very alienating in a certain sense. On the other hand, in response to that, you have this kind of communal, Rorty is all about founding these new communities and forget about what's true. What's true is not important. It's what is functional for your community. What helps your community? You know, and so, the danger for that is, as Oz Guinness points out, it kind of devolves into a sort of new tribalism, you know, where you have your communal identity. And you can see it in America with identity politics. You know, I align myself with this identity, and that's the identity that I'm going to publicly put forward. And my social agenda is to, A, define myself, and B, enact social legislation that protects and furthers my group agenda. The way Christianity is different is that it is at once a kind of a communal identity, but it's a communal identity that seeks to empty itself in the world. You know, the Christian community is the only club that doesn't exist for its own sake. It exists for the sake of its non-members. So that's a very, very big difference. And Christians will never kind of shy away from the meta-narrative, from the claim to meta-narrative. That is, the God I serve is the God you ought to be serving. And I'm going to love you whether or not you serve him. But always the undertone is, I want you to be one of us. I want you to find what I found. You know, you're just one beggar telling another beggar where to find bread. And that is something different than the postmodern emphasis on community. It's very much more self-absorbed. Yes, Mara. Yeah, I thought that that Dr. Jackman's thing this morning was very, very helpful in that it put Christian doing in a really nice context. That is, you do as an expression of your trust in these promises. The doing is not primary. It is grace that is primary, and the doing flows out of that. So in that case, you know, in light of 1 Peter 1 up to 2:3, that kind of ongoing dynamic of identity, the obedience that I have to God, or the times when I screw up, you know, is what I need to be grounded in, are those promises of God for me. He is not going to abandon me. God is not the kind of father who kicks his kids out onto the street if they've been terribly naughty. Would you do that as a father? Well, you're not a father yet, but, you know, when you become a father. I think you're not a father. Okay. I wouldn't. You know, even though there have been times when I really wanted to rip my kids' head off. Kids' heads off, collectively. You know, but there's something about fatherhood, and especially as expressed in Christ. There's a you need to respect the Father, but the Father's grace and love for you is solid. That's what the cross and the resurrection mean. They are historical facts. So if it's taken the wrong way, I suppose it could have this guilt-ridden, you know, identity of I need to do. But and there are Christians who walk around like that. Aha, aha. Right, and what I would say about that is that is a modernist way of construing identity. I am what I do. If I am successful, then I am worthy. If I am unsuccessful, then I am unworthy. And if, you know, I've been in this position. Ministry hasn't been going that great. People have not been coming to the Lord in truckloads and truckloads, you know, or whatever. That at that point, I need a Christian identity. Somebody who is grounded in the promises of God will say, okay, could I be doing something better? Is God trying to teach me something? But I know that God is not abandoning me. That's not something God does. He doesn't abandon his children. My calling, therefore, is to be faithful and to do what I do to the best of my ability without letting my ministry become a kind of worthometer, you know. How worthy am I to today? Did I teach well? Did I preach well? Were people helped? People weren't helped. I must be a wreck. That's not Christian. Well, it's both, isn't it? My identity comes from what I am. What am I? Yes. Yeah. That's true. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I would agree with a lot of that. And maybe the way I put it is just because I'm dealing with the question of identity. What I would want to avoid, though, what I think is very unattractive to the watching postmodern world, is a Christian who said, okay, is a Christian who say, okay, I've got all the answers, I've got my identity sewed up, and if you don't, too bad. I'm going to live out these qualities, and if you're not having these qualities, you know, and there's this kind of, I've got it, you don't, sort of thing, which is, in a sense, it's true. We do have something that. Yeah. 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 That's. Yes, it is. It is method. But I would still want to say, at a principial level, at a theological level, Christians are part of their identity is we are works in progress. And so even this, you know, we shouldn't be obsessed with our identities. You know, we do want to live this stuff out. We don't want to be morbidly introspective or anything like that. But, you know that you are a work in progress. There are things you're struggling with. God hasn't brought you the whole way there yet. You know, that impacts who you think you are. Yeah. Yeah, I don't think they're mutually exclusive. It's the already not yet. Ellis? I would agree with that. I would also say the thing that Jesus is pointing to when he's saying have faith in a little child is rather children know, especially children in first century Palestine, because of their negative social position, they're nothings. They know dependence. They're not going to try to earn God's favor, or they're not going to try to earn anybody's favor because they can't. They have nothing with which to earn it. So there is this, unless you knucklehead disciples get it together, or realize how un-got it together you have, unless you stop arguing about things like position and thinking that you can earn an entree into God, you'll never even get into the kingdom. You have to become like this little child who knows he has nothing to offer and just receives the kingdom as a gift. So.